Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Well, on this Martin Luther King Day and Inauguration Day and very, very grey day here in Seattle, today's show is all about food and fear, although not necessarily in that order. Coming up in a moment, we'll explore the Fear Project with award-winning journalist Jamal Yogis. He'll share his journey into the depths of facing his fears and how facing them help change his life. He'll share what our most primal emotion can teach us about survival, success, surfing, and love, and how it can help us achieve a more rewarding life. And with all this freezing fog we've been experiencing the last few days, I think one of the nicest ways to end a hard day at work is to come home, open your front door to the aroma of good, healthy home cooking. And if that meal's been cooking while you've been at work and there's only one pot to wash, well, then what could be better? Coming up around 12:40, we'll talk with the queen of slow cooking, Michelle Cicilline. Ever since her honeymoon 40 years ago, she's traveled to Italy several times a year with her husband, renowned wine expert Charles Cicilline. They go to visit winemakers, research Michelle's cookbooks and food articles, and lead groups on culinary tours. Her new book is called The Mediterranean Slow Cooker, and we're not talking boring old pasta here. You know, you want to think spicy chicken with green olives from Morocco, bandit's lamb from Greece, and Portuguese pulled pork and more. But first, I'm very pleased to welcome an amazing writer and storyteller who spent years working on The Fear Project. Jamal Yogis is an award-winning journalist whose work has appeared in ESPN, the magazine, the Washington Post, Surfer magazine, and many others. His first book, Saltwater Buddha, has received international praise and is the subject of a forthcoming documentary. His new book is called The Fear Project, What Our Most Primal Emotion Taught Me About Survival, Success, Surfing, and Love. Welcome, Jamal Yogis. I can't speak this morning. I just took a cough drop and it's numbed my lips.
It's the fog. It has us all in a flurry. It's funny. I've been doing some swims to my events in the freezing cold water sort of as a publicity stunt / adventure, because a big part of the Fear Project is how outdoor adventure can help us deal with stresses in our everyday lives. And I got out of the river yesterday in Portland, and I was doing an interview, and I couldn't move my jaw. They're like, how was that? So I know the feeling, but I think you sound beautiful to me.
Well, thank you. And it's starting to wear off now. I took it about half an hour ago, and I was like, oh, I think that was a mistake. My lips are numb now. But you mentioned you've been doing swims to some of your book signings. I mean, we're not talking little, you know, a little few strokes here. I read that you were launching, and I don't know if you actually did this, whether conditions were permissible, but I read that you were going to do 2.4 miles across the San Francisco Bay to the launch of your book. Did you do that?
I did do that, yeah. It was a lot of fun. I was nervous about it, but I was with Jamie Patrick, a world-famous ultra swimmer who does these 40-mile swims, and so this was like, you know, what he does for breakfast. And we swam from Treasure Island to the bookstore in San Francisco, which is on the Embarcadero in San Francisco, so it seemed like a good James Bond entry. And I really highly recommend it for anyone who has a fear of public speaking to do something a little bit scary and athletic before your speech, because I've never been more calm at a speech than after getting out of the bay for an hour and a half swim. And it's like, well, I just survived that, and so this really seems tame all of a sudden, this thing that would normally get my anxiety really going.
Right, right. And you did that just this month, so we're not talking summer months here.
Yeah, no, it was just a couple weeks ago, and I did the Willamette in Portland yesterday. It was so much fun. I did it again there, and I had a Paralympiad swimmer who is kayaking with me who had survived polio as a boy, and so he was like my true courageous one on the trip, but he was watching that I wouldn't freeze.
Oh, wow.
It was real inspiration.
Wow. And so you're up here in Seattle today. You're actually going to be speaking at Elliott Bay Books tonight. Are you going to do any swimming to Elliott Bay Books tonight?
I wanted to. I wasn't able to get a kayaker and whatnot together, but we're doing a run from Seward Park, 5 p.m. meetup there, and we're going to run to Elliott Bay. And the reason I'm doing these sorts of runs and swims is because in the book I talk with neuroscientists and psychologists about what are the best ways to deal with fear, and exercise kept coming back, and the fact that fear in its most primal sense is just energy. It's meant to motivate us to action. And so often in our lives, we're getting all these, I have all this fear and stress and anxiety, but we're just sitting around at our desks and there's no outlet for it. And outdoor exercise particularly is powerful, I think, because it taps into that primal part of the brain, which is where fear comes from. And you know, when we were hunters and gatherers and we had a fear response, maybe we were running out of food, we went for a run. We went running after our food, literally. And so that is really what the body expects to do. So it feels so good. That's why it's such a stress release. And so it makes it fun before the reading. Plus, it calms me down before the public speaking.
Well, I read that that's how you cured your well, I don't know that you have a cure, your fear of public speaking, but you've learned to definitely cope with it. We're going to take a very quick break. When we come back, I want to talk about how this book came together, because you put a lot of study into this. You shared a lot of your own personal fears in this and other people's. And it just is such a great book. It's funny. It's serious. It's packed full of neuroscience to support the facts. So we're going to take a very quick break. My guest is Jamal Yogis. His book is called The Fear Project, What Our Most Primal Emotion Taught Me About Survival, Success, Surfing, and Love. And you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Not a lot. And the chorus goes like this. Oh, baby, here comes the fear again. Oh, oh, the end is near again. Oh,
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
If you love dogs, tune in to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, live every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. We'll talk about everything dog and interview authors, experts, and amazing organizations, both locally and nationally. And don't even get me started on the pet food industry. I'm Julie Forbes. Find us online at www.dogradioshow.com and also as a free podcast on iTunes. The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, an evolved perspective on life with dogs.
Coming next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Is the American dream still alive? It is for the Jonas family. Find out how hard work and a small hobby took them from a 3-acre piece of land to a 36-acre farm and international success. Join us next Monday at noon Pacific, right here on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Now I'm a farmer.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Radio with no added hormones or preservatives. All natural, alternative talk, 1150 AM.
With the edges taken off, when you can't even define what it is that you're frightened of.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. My guest in this segment is award-winning journalist Jamal Yogis. He's written a fascinating account of one of our oldest evolutionary traits, fear. His book is called The Fear Project. And Jamal, I want to just share a little of your background, if you would, with our listeners, because you did some pretty astonishing feats in the book. As you were journeying through this, but you say that as a kid you were really quite nervy, you were afraid of monsters under the bed, and this continued on into your teen years. So tell us a little bit about how you grew up and then how this led into getting interested in fear.
Yeah, well, we all come in with our unique fear footprint, and all of us fear, but some of us fear in certain areas more than others. And I had a tendency towards social anxiety. Maybe because we moved around a lot, but also shyness is partly genetic. And so there I was, you know, wandering the playground alone at a new school, and it was always terrifying for me to approach friends or people that I wanted to play with. And so I would just wait until someone approached me. And that developed into a personality, and I sort of learned ways to wield it to get attention. You know, I became like the aloof artistic guy and mysterious at the party to try to get the girl, you know, that role sort of thing. And it's funny, it worked okay, you know, but was that me? Did that have to be me? Once I got into the work world, I realized, you know, that aloof attitude doesn't work that well when you're trying to pitch a story. You know, you need to go and talk to the editor. Mm-hmm. I became a journalist. And, you know, we live in a world where you really have to be a go-getter, sink or swim. And so that was part of it, was that I was on tour for my first book also, and public speaking gave me nerves. All these things were sort of hitting me at once, and I was also going through a breakup with a girlfriend. And breakups, when you look at divorce statistics and health, I mean, they're one of the most stressful things humans undergo. And so all those things were hitting me at once, and it just finally came to a head, and I said, I have to figure something else out. I need to figure out a new approach to fear. And it also struck me that, you know, according to the United Nations, we were living longer and healthier, and the world was less violent than at any time in history, and yet anxiety disorders were going through the roof, mental illness was going through the roof, our anxiety medications were being taken at such alarming rates. And yet, compared to the old ancient world, we were much safer, and it seemed like, what is this dichotomy? I wanted to try to crack the case for myself and for others, for other Americans who are suffering from anxiety and fear. So that's how I came into writing the book. And it's funny, I don't even think the book would have become an actual book had I not been researching fear, because I'd come across this quote by Eleanor Roosevelt, "Do one thing that scares you every day." And when I was sort of hemming and hawing about, is this going to be my next book, I thought, well, it's a good idea, and I'll just start pitching it to some editors, and that will be my fear project for the day. And the first editor I contacted loved the idea, and we did a deal a week later. But I'm the kind of person who might have hemmed and hawed for a year about that and then shelved the project or something. So it was Eleanor saved the day, and I highly recommend trying her homework of do one little thing that scares you every day.
That's good advice. And you actually said that of all the things you tried during the course of this book and before when you were researching the Fear Project, the scariest thing was actually writing it.
It absolutely was. I mean, I think any artist or writer, what you're basically asking is you're saying, I'm going to bare my soul and I'm asking you to love it. I'm asking you to love me. And what gives us the reason public speaking is so scary is because, at least according to evolutionary biologists, that we were wandering around the Serengeti as tribes. And if you were ostracized from that tribe, that was a death sentence. It's not now, but that fear became innate in us. It became hardwired. And so anytime you're saying, I'm up here on the podium, please accept me, or I've written this book, especially when the book includes your personal stories of
right.
falling in love and being heartbroken and all those things, it's you're really being vulnerable. And so it was, I wrote this book in fear and yet also in love because I love writing. And it was that relationship really that allowed me to use all the things that I was learning to write the book and to break through those fears and try to write courageously. And so writing the book was the biggest part of the Fear Project, but I didn't want to write about that because I thought, well, only other writers are going to be interested in this. So I used great white shark diving and surfing big waves and commitment phobia and things like that as the stories. But ultimately, I think artists and anybody who's presenting something to the world, they deal with immense fear and stress. And it's only in doing it and then realizing, people think I'm okay at least, if I believe in my project and I'm authentic, even if I don't win the Pulitzer Prize, people, if you're authentic, they generally say, oh, that's cool. He's doing what he believes. And or she's, that Vicky, she really is great on the radio because she's just herself. And I like that. And you start to realize that and the fear starts to go away. But it's that before you open up that can be so scary.
Right, right. And I've talked with many neuroscientists. We know that the brain gets hardwired, but the good news is that we can start to change that. And this obviously was your intent going out on some of these adventures. I wonder if you'd share your adventure when you went out with the great white sharks. Because I was telling you this is one of my fears, swimming in the ocean.
Yeah, who isn't afraid of great whites and seeing Jaws? And I surf every day in these waters off San Francisco that are supposedly the most great white infested in the world. And so I was fascinated with great whites like all of us are. They're fascinating, and yet I also had these nightmares about them. And I was interested in how there could be that dichotomy of intellectual fascination and attraction with fear and a totally different emotion than the one that I thought about. And so the reason for that I discovered is because fear is sort of at the core of your brain and it's sending these unconscious impulses without you thinking at all, consciously. And the outer layers of the brain, the cortex, are doing the intellectual thinking, and oftentimes they don't really communicate. It's sort of a caveman talking with an absent-minded professor, and they just have communication problems. But at any rate, I decided I needed to see a shark. And so I took a trip 23 miles off the coast of San Francisco into these really cold, dark islands called the Farallones, and they're called the Devil's Teeth because they look literally like devil's teeth popping out of the water.
Well, there's the fear building.
It looks like Dr. Evil's lair out there. And sure enough, there's all these great whites 20 feet long. They're like Airstream trailers with teeth, and they're hunting their favorite food. And when we saw one, I was going to get in the water with a cage. They don't let you just swim around out there. And So I did have the cage there, but it's still, you know, you're thinking about Richard Dreyfuss and Jaws cage getting rattled, and it didn't seem like much defense. And the cage has a huge hole on the top where it seems like the shark could just jump in. So at any rate, I don't want to give away the story, but I will say that since seeing that a shark in the flesh and really falling in love with sharks in a new way, I haven't had shark nightmares since. And that's sharks are basically an irrational fear. They kill fewer than one person per year in the United States. A similar number of people are killed by vending machines falling on them.
That's interesting.
They're not out to get you. And when they do occasionally bite people, it's usually because they're sampling and saying, oh, you're not a seal, I'll let you go. And occasionally those bites can be fatal, but not out to get you, you know, and to hear that Jaws music every time you get in the water is silly. The most dangerous thing that you did to get there was driving there. And yet it's very hard to control these ancient fears of the wild, snakes, spiders, sharks, the dark. And it takes some exposure therapy.
Yeah, I can believe that. I very quickly was terrified of polar bears when I was a child because my mother had told me, yes, they could kill someone. And so I was convinced they were going to escape from the zoo in the big city I lived in and come to our house. And for years and years, all my life, I had nightmares about polar bears until I saw them in the flesh up on the Hudson Bay. And I've not had a nightmare since. Amazing.
So interesting how our imaginations are more powerful often than the real thing.
Absolutely.
And it's not 100% true, but almost always if you're afraid of something and you're thinking about what will it be like if, and you're getting all of that faster heart rate and anxiety thinking about it, that just doing it will probably be much better. One, because you're present, and animals have... they're basically present with their fear because they don't have this huge imagination and ability to think about the future. But we have this weird wiring where we can imagine multiple horrible outcomes that might happen. And those outcomes actually route directly to the fear center, the amygdala, and they send out this response that you should only get if there's a threat right there. But, it's just the biology we're saddled with, and we need a bit of a software update. But I think the understanding of how the brain works is our best shot at not being duped by fear.
Right, right. Well, along with the adventures, you do look at that in the book. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to look at a couple of things. Why fear spreads between us, because it certainly does. We get into this groupthink state. And how we can use the latest neuroscience to transform fear memories. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest is Jamal Yogis. His book is called The Fear Project. We'll be right back.
Enjoy your food, but eat less. A simple way to eat less is to be mindful of what you're eating. This is registered dietitian Jim White. Eat slowly and enjoy the taste and texture of your food. Use hunger and fullness as cues to recognize when you've had enough. Healthy meals start with fruits, vegetables, and smaller portions of proteins and grains. And don't forget to choose low-fat or fat-free dairy. This is registered dietitian Jim White. Visit eatright.org for more healthy tips.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job, and building your business. overcoming life's big challenges, and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772. Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has a new Facebook page, so you can see what's happening on our show and what we're up to between shows. Like us on Facebook and look out for upcoming contest drawings.
News, traffic, and weather? Now you can get your information fixed weekdays on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. My guest is award-winning journalist and author Jamal Yogis. He has written a really great book. It's called The Fear Project: What Our Most Primal Emotion Taught Me About Survival, Success, Surfing, and Love. And it's somewhat autobiographical. He shares many of his fears and adventures with us throughout this book. But he also... Jamal, you talked with many, many neuroscientists. How long did it take you to actually put this book together?
It was a good year in the research and then probably a year of writing. Yeah.
And one of the things you talk about in the book, which I thought was so true, is, you know, thinking about witch hunts and all these urban legends we hear about. Halloween candy was one of the examples you used in the book. But we have this groupthink mentality. And of course, with the way the media presents itself today, that also, you know, helps build and develop fear. But talk to us a little bit about, if you would, how fear spreads between us and how we can stop that groupthink mentality.
Yeah, it's fascinating because we all want to be part of the group. We don't want to be rejected, as I was speaking about before. So groupthink is quite common because nobody wants to be the odd one out. And with fear, it intensifies because take an experiment where you're flashing different faces on a screen. You can flash a scared face or an angry face so fast on the screen that consciously you have no idea what you've seen, but the fear response recognizes it and sends the adrenaline and the cortisol into the body, starts at the faster heart rate, and the fight or flight or freeze response. Amazing, right? Happy faces take the longest to register. Why? Because if something's safe, you don't really have to notice it. It's not imperative for your survival. So we have what psychologists often call negativity bias, where we latch onto these threats and we emphasize them, we remember them more vividly. And that can create a whole worldview about, oh, isn't the world so terrible? Because, well, it is if you're just emphasizing the bad stuff. And so we really have to learn to turbocharge the good. But your question about fear spreading is a good one, because if you imagine this macro level where we're all watching news that focuses only on threats, we're hardwired to emphasize the threats, we're looking at each other and basically passing around these scared faces unconsciously. We can even pick up fear on each other through smell. You know, that was sort of, you can smell fear on someone as a saying, but scientists are actually being able to back that up now.
Right.
That the smell of fear, it's subtle. You know, you wouldn't notice it like, oh, that person smells scared, but you're unconsciously feeling a little bit anxious around someone else. Perhaps because of smell, perhaps because of their facial expression, but we have an ability to pick up on these things subtly. And so fear spreads quickly, and the way to debunk groupthink is really through knowledge, right? It's through each fear needs to be investigated individually. So because fear wants to make these blanket statements. For example, I was bit by a dog in Mexico when I was young. And after that bite, I got nervous around dogs, but I also had this queasy feeling around Mexico, which is silly, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the fear response wants to say all dogs are dangerous, Mexico is dangerous, when really it was just that one particular dog. That was a good fear response. Stay away from that one dog. But I know well that most dogs are friendly. I've been around them. And it takes, but Oh, and we all know this, but in the media, a lot of the issues are vague. They're new. You know, is what's going to happen if we don't avoid the fiscal cliff? You know, none of us know, and none of us are experts, but we're just passing around the fear. Now, there is such thing as a good fear, where it motivates you to positive change, but when we don't understand that we emphasize the threat and then pass it around, something small can quickly snowball into being much bigger than it needs to be and creating chronic stress. And I think that's why anxiety disorders are so high right now, because there's sort of this low buzz where everything could be a threat, but you're not really sure. Nothing is apparent or actually in your face. It's just like, well, is everything falling apart or is everything going really well? I don't know, but there's a low buzz of anxiety,
right.
I'm trying to figure it out. So it's a complicated situation we're in, but understanding the biology really helps.
It does, yeah. And so you talked with a lot of people, and we're almost out of time, but I wanted to get this in. You talked with a lot of people about how we can transform our fear memories. One of those folks you talked with was Rick.
Daniela Schiller is the one who talks about memory. It's fascinating, and because I don't have much time, basically you can use your thoughts to change your brain structure, and it's one of the most amazing discoveries of the last 10 years, how plastic our brains are. And fear memories are strong. We emphasize them. But every time you remember something scary from your past, you're actually contacting that real estate in your brain, so to speak, that actual memory, and you're reconsolidating it with whatever you're doing while remembering that experience. So if you're remembering an embarrassing moment you had, say your first kiss, and you botched it, and and if you were just brooding and alone and feeling sorry for yourself, you actually reconsolidate that memory with those feelings of aloneness and how sad that is. But if you joke about it with your friends and say, God, that was silly, it was seventh grade, it's not a big deal, that memory is reconsolidated with that laughter and the feeling of friendship. So in short, we know this, but now they can prove it in the brain, and the studies are so fascinating and brilliant, and I had an opportunity to be a guinea pig in the book to see how this works. And it just gives you the confidence that, yes, I can get over that trauma that's haunting me or that silly thing that makes me nervous. So it's possible.
Right. Excellent book. Rick Hansen, author of The Buddha's Brain, says yogis weaves together neuroscience, dramatic true stories, and practical wisdom in a fascinating, important book that moves with page-turning verve of a thriller. I really enjoyed reading it. Enjoyed talking with you. A final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today, Jamal?
I just hope that everybody comes to Seward Park today to run with me along the water to Elliott Bay Book Company. We're going to meet at 5 p.m. in the Seward Park parking lot, and then the Elliott Bay event starts at 7 p.m. So if you like to run, come with me. If you don't like to run, come to the bookstore, and we'll have a group therapy session.
There you go. And that's tonight at Monday, January 21st at 7 p.m. at Elliott Bay Books. Jamal Yogis, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you. It was really fun.
And you can find out more about Jamal and his work at his website. It's J-A-I-M-A-L, Yogis, JamalYogis.com. The book, The Fear Project, What Our Most Primal Emotion Taught Me About Survival, Success, Surfing, and Love. And please do stay with us. We'll be right back. We're going to talk about Mediterranean slow cooking. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
I am afraid of the day. I am afraid to walk outside. And of what people say.
Antioxidants, you've heard of them, but do you know what they're good for or where to get them? This is Sylvia Escott Stump of the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. Antioxidants, they destroy the free radicals that cause cellular damage, and eating foods that are rich in antioxidants may help prevent cancer and heart disease. These foods include red wine in addition to grape juice, whole grain pasta, eggs, seafood, and canned beans, brightly colored vegetables, carrots, squash, broccoli, all the peppers, sweet potatoes, tomatoes, and kale are other tasty sources. And for those of you with a sweet tooth, good news. Honey, brown sugar, and maple syrup, in addition to fruits like blueberries, cantaloupe, peaches, and strawberries, also contain significant levels of antioxidants. Encouraging you to eat right, I'm registered dietitian Sylvia Escott Stump with the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics.
OMG! Grammar abuses, no, LOL! Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Cornerstone Home Lending and Duval, we cover the world of animals. This week, January 27th, it's Shelter, Rescue, Sanctuary, and anything that helps our animal friends Sunday. We'll do our regular interviews and continue our education on disaster preparedness with our animal friends in mind with Suzanne Beauregard. Plus, we'll welcome Natural Pet Pantry to our Animal World family. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Coming next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Is the American dream still alive? It is for the Jonas family. Find out how hard work and a small hobby took them from a 3-acre piece of land to a 36-acre farm and international success. Join us next Monday at noon Pacific, right here on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Now I'm a farmer, and I'm digging, 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 digging.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Like what you hear? Be sure and support the sponsors who support your favorite programs on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Have a banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy. Give it to gravy, Davy. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Try a tomato plate, too. Here's Cacciatore, Dory.
And welcome back, everyone. You are listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. My guest in this segment is Michelle Ciccoloni. She's the author of 17 cookbooks, author or co-author of 17 cookbooks, including The Sopranos Family Cookbook, a New York Times bestseller, The Italian Slow Cooker, and The French Slow Cooker. She is a cooking teacher and Italian culinary tour guide. She writes about food, wine, and travel for many publications. And her latest book is called The Mediterranean Slow Cooker. And I just told her in all sincerity, this has got some of the best recipes I've seen in a slow cooker book. Michelle Ciccoloni, welcome to the show.
Be with you.
Glad to have you. And so I want to just talk a little bit about what's in this book so that people are just waiting to hear how this comes together. But recipes such as spicy chicken with green olives from Morocco, bandit's lamb from Greece, Portuguese pulled pork, Turkish lamb meatloaf, coffee caramel flan from Spain. And I read in the beginning of your book that you said you feel that you're one of the luckiest people alive because you love what you do. So tell us, in a nutshell, what you do.
Well, my career has evolved over the years. I started out working for different magazines, and now I do mostly writing my cookbooks, and I get to do a lot of traveling so that I can do research and discover new recipes, and that's kind of what inspired me to write this book. I was in the Mediterranean area. I've spent a lot of time there and realized how similar the many similarities there are amongst the countries that border the Mediterranean and the ways that they cook, and all of the wonderful slowly cooked dishes like the tagines and the olas in Spain and daubes in France. There are these similar slow cooked dishes that would work perfectly in a slow cooker.
Mm. And you do a lot of your traveling, or maybe all of your traveling, with your husband, who's a wine expert, Charles Ciccoloni.
That's right.
And how does that help? Do you agree on wine with him when you're traveling?
Well, I don't really. It's the wine. He always says his job is opening the wine, and my job is preparing the food. So there's a clear division there of which wine we're going to drink. But generally, my taste and his are very similar.
Mm. So you mentioned that you got interested in, you know, how these foods were slow cooked, because some of the best meals I've had have been slow cooked one way or another. Mm-hmm. You know, I think of when I lived in San Diego, and for Thanksgiving a couple of times we went out to the desert and cooked the turkey overnight. You dig a big hole in the sand and cook it in the sand overnight. And it was always delicious. But many people, I think that slow cookers are kind of boring and just a staple in the kitchen. So you're here to really, I mean, and you've written several books on this, so you're trying to change this perception.
Yes, of course, because when you think about a slow cooker, it is just a pot, excuse me, for braising, but it's an electrified pot. So any kind of delicious dish that you would normally braise on top of the stove or in the oven is going to work out beautifully in the slow cooker. So that opens up a whole world of possibilities. It was the secret to my realizing that it's not just about chili and stew. You know, there's so many more things that will work in that slow cooker.
Right. And I think one of the best things for me, I use my slow cooker a lot, is, you know, often you come home from work and you're too tired and you may rush out and grab some junk food or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But,
yeah,
you know, if you walk through that door and you smell dinner cooking.
Oh, it's such a wonderful thing to come home to. The whole family reacts that way. It's really a delight. It saves you a lot of cleanup time, a lot of prep time. You can make a big batch of food and make several meals of it. There are so many ways that you can use the slow cooker. It's really much more versatile than we give it credit for sometimes.
Yeah, and at one point we never used to hear of dessert really being made in slow cookers. It was those, uh-huh, you know, stews and soups and chilies.
Right.
So do you have a favorite that you've included in the book? Because you have a lot of desserts in here. That's my favorite meal, dessert. So, do you have a favorite in here?
I would say one of the cheesecakes would be my favorite. I love the cannoli cheesecake, which is sort of an invention of mine. It was inspired by an urge for a good cannoli. And not having access to one, I decided to make a cheesecake of it instead, using those very same flavors. And the slow cooker does a great, it's really the best way I know to cook cheesecakes, because the cakes will never crack on the top. And the slow cooker acts like a water bath for cooking the cheesecake very slowly and gently in that steamy atmosphere that you would, if you were baking it in the oven, you would need to do a cheesecake in a water bath. So I would recommend that one very, very highly. But I also adore the flans. They're so simple to put together. I use sweetened condensed milk and evaporated milk. So they're ingredients I always have on hand. And I could just go to the pantry and pull out a few ingredients and make these absolutely luscious and very easy flans.
Right. And you've got recipes in here, as we said, from, you know, Greece, France, Italy, Spain, Portugal, mm-hmm, Morocco. Do you have a favorite all-time dish?
All-time favorite dish? Oh, that's, you know, it depends on my mood, of course. I adore the short ribs. That's a favorite winter dish of mine. I make that quite a lot. I have a couple of variations on the theme. One is with, I think that's actually one in my Italian slow cooker book that I had done with balsamic vinegar, which is so easy and so good. But in this Mediterranean slow cooker book, I have Rioja short ribs with chorizo, and they get a great smoky flavor from the chorizo. And I think ribs are probably my favorite meat to cook in a slow cooker. Pork ribs or beef ribs always turn out so delicious and falling off the bone tender.
I think that's the secret. Yeah.
Yes.
So, you know, a lot of people may not have used a slow cooker. I read in your material that about 85% of American households have mm-hmm. slow cookers. And I asked friends, do you have one? Yes. Do you use it? No.
That is often the case. It's too bad because if you have a repertoire of three dishes, you know, chili, stew, and soup that you make in the slow cooker, you're going to get pretty tired of that really quickly. And a lot of people thought that they had to use like a canned soup to flavor their pot roast or a seasoning packet. And those were the kinds of recipes they were making. Well, if you use canned soup in all of your dishes, it's all going to taste the same. But my thinking was that if you start with good ingredients and you put good ingredients into the pot, you're going to get something delicious out of the pot. So use your own flavorings and your own seasonings and fresh onion and garlic and carrots and other things to make something wonderful. And that's why I think people have in many cases stopped using their slow cooker not because they didn't like the result, but because they weren't adventurous enough
right.
to expand their horizon.
Right. You know, and one of the reasons I love mine is it's one pot to cook. Unless, of course,
yes.
you stand something in there, but for the most part, it's one pot to cook, to wash up, I'm sorry.
Yes.
I hate washing up. Who doesn't hate washing up? But
sure.
One thing I like about the book, and I want to mention, is you have out-of-the-pot extras in there. Tell us about those.
Well, for example, I have a recipe for cooking basic beans or chickpeas. And then once you've got them cooked, how will you use them? So, for example, I have three variations on hummus. Now, we're all eating hummus. We're learning that it's very good for us. It's very delicious. And it's a pleasure. Kids love it. Everybody loves it. It's a great party food. So, but why buy the store-bought stuff, which is expensive and maybe has some undesirable ingredients in it that we don't want to eat too much of, like sodium or who knows what else?
Right.
I figure if you buy a one-pound package of chickpeas and you cook it in the slow cooker, now you've got that pound of cooked chickpeas, you can turn it into your own wonderful hummus, flavor it any way you like, put in extra garlic or less if you don't like it, more lemon or, you know, whatever, however you like it, and do things to your own taste. So that's the idea for the out of the pot. I do a basic poached salmon, nice thick slices of poached salmon in the slow cooker. And then I have three ways that you can serve it, three different sauces that you might want to try. There's a Greek-style tzatziki, and then there's a French-style tomato citronette, and finally an Italian-style arugula pesto. So you can have that basic salmon, poached salmon dish, and then vary it in different ways. So I think that helps also to make the book appealing.
Right, right. Now, what typical things do we have in our pantry if we're interested in doing Mediterranean cooking?
I think that olives are something that really adds a great Mediterranean flavor all around the Mediterranean. People eat a lot of olives either in their dishes or as an appetizer or accompaniment. So I'd certainly keep those on hand. Beans, as I mentioned. And the great thing about making your own beans in the slow cooker, too, is that you can experiment with some of the really interesting varieties that you'll never find in a can, like the Greek gigante beans are wonderful. They're about an inch long and really meaty tasting. But you won't find those in cans too easily. So you can go into a store and buy a whole bunch of different beans and have fun trying all the different ones.
Right.
I'd also recommend people to have some Greek yogurt. I use that quite a lot in the book, either as a topping on a soup or for some of the sauces that accompany the I have Greek meatballs, for example, and I serve that with a little yogurt topping, and it's very, very delicious and fun to eat.
Making me hungry.
Good.
If I'm buying a slow cooker, what kind of things do I want to look for? Because, and I'll share a story that, you know, I had to buy a new slow cooker several years ago, and I could only find one that it didn't lift, the pot did not lift out of the actual cooking part. And I found it really irritating because it was difficult to wash. So what kind of tips do you give people about buying slow cookers?
Well, if that's all you can find in your area, try looking online, because there are just dozens and dozens of models to choose from. And if you go with a good manufacturer, you'll get something very nice. And if you go online, you can really select the features that are important to you. Certainly, you want a crock that lifts out of the exterior holder for easy cooking. And it also makes it possible to serve from it if you have one that like
that's
that.
Right.
I also like one with a timer, and that's a very important function if you're going to be out of the house. So you could set it for 5 hours or 6 hours or wherever you want, and then it will shut off or switch automatically to low to keep warm until you get home. So that's an important feature. And there are just so many features that you can choose from. I like one with a glass top so that you can look in without having to lift the cover on the slow cooker,
mm-hmm.
but you can peek in easily and see how the cooking is progressing. And what else do I like? I'm trying to think. Well, there are so many ones to choose from, and so many great features nowadays.
Right,
some
right.
of them, for example, you can actually do your browning right in the slow cooker. One thing I would say is that you should get as big a size as you can possibly manage, because I for one, have no problem with having leftovers of slow cooker dishes. They really reheat well. They freeze well. So you can, even if you're just cooking for one or two, make several meals at a time
right.
with a big slow cooker.
Right, right. Awesome. Well, I'm going to test out some of the recipes in here. The rice pudding brulee is one of them for sure.
Oh, that's a great one.
And a final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today, Michelle?
Well, I think I'd like to tell them that there's a lot more to slow cooking than just the kind of dishes we thought that was, our pots were good for. You can have a lot of fun making very adventuresome foods from all around the world.
Yeah, and if Mediterranean is not their bag, this book is called The Mediterranean Slow Cooker, but you also have a French one, an Italian one, I believe?
Yes, that's right. The French slow cooker and the Italian slow cooker.
There we go. And your website has more information on there. Could you give out your website for people, please?
Yes, it is simply my name, Michelle, M-I-C-H-E-L-E, Ciccolone, S-C-I-C-O-L-O-N-E.com. And there's a lot of information and a couple of recipes posted on Amazon.com if you'd like to take a look for the Mediterranean slow cooker there.
Well, awesome. Thank you, Michelle Ciccolone. I love that name, Ciccolone.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with us today. And Michelle's book again called The Mediterranean Slow Cooker. And if you check out her website, you'll see other recipes on there. And I'm not kidding you, because you know I love my food. There are some fantastic recipes in here. Not your boring slow cooker book by any means. I want to thank you for being with us today. If you want to learn any more about today's show, if you have any comments or feedbacks, you can reach me at info@conversationslive.net, info@conversationslive.net. You can also reach me at the 800 number, which is 495-7617, 800-495-7617. 7617. And I'd be glad to hear from you. The podcast will be up by tomorrow at the very latest if you didn't catch all of the show or you'd like to listen to it again. And I want to thank you for being with us today. We'll be back next week with an all live new show. And I want to just wish you a happy week. And until then, live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Coming next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Is the American dream still alive? It is for the Jonas family. Find out how hard work and a small hobby took them from a 3-acre piece of land to a 36-acre farm and international success. Join us next Monday at noon Pacific, right here on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.